thank you for your time. I'm sure we'll be talking again soon, my friend.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you for your leadership and your voice on this, buddy.
All right. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. All right, you all. So I'm out of here. And as John Lee Johnson used to say, stay out of trouble. But as I like to say, and my good friend Paul Muth agrees, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
All right. You guys are doing it today. Carol had a really great show on Korea, and it's going to bring a scholar here, too. I don't know when that's happening. But, you know, Greg Palast, the guy that's done a lot of work on CrossCheck, in fact, the reason why many people know about it, is got an updated version of his film. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah, and he keeps revising it as things.
Democracy money can buy.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and I saw one I was watching recently about CrossCheck being the motherlode of voter purge scams, and there was a veteran named Willie Stein in Florida. This was back when this first started, when Bush stole the election from Gore.
Yeah.
Or the Republicans stole it from the Democrats then. And how many thousands of people who were marked to have felony convictions. And see, this was that merger for me, that sort of intersection I've been talking about.
Felony disenfranchisement.
Felony disenfranchisement being the next movement that we really need to look, one of the next things that we really need to make into a movement in the country, because of the loss of that losing your voting rights to me is an assault on the First Amendment, because your vote is your voice.
Yeah.
In so many
Since
ways.
Since the Constitution doesn't have any provision for
you see what I'm
for
saying?
Guaranteeing our voting, which is
I was listening
another
to
flaw to the document.
I was listening to an NFL player who was from England talk about that
really?
This country could not be this country without the First Amendment. It's something else.
Mm.
If you take away the right to protest and the right to your freedom of speech, it turns into something else. And I understand that there are very important discussions we have around freedom of speech. You can't walk into a movie theater and full of people and keep yelling fire, right? The irresponsibility is not freedom. That's not what we're talking about. But certainly you can't take away the vote of a citizen and say that you're not infringing upon their freedom of speech.
Yeah. Well, some of these corporate interests, they think that since they're persons, corporations are persons,
right,
that talking about fracking,
brothers.
Yeah, Koch brothers who underwrote. I don't know
exactly
whether you treated that. They,
exactly.
The Kansas Project was funded by the Koch brothers, and they are the ones who produced CrossCheck.
So
I was shocked when I heard that the Illinois was still using it. It's ridiculous. That in Virginia is really shocking. Virginia has a Democratic governor who could scotch it. I thought Eric was involved, but the discourse around it is I don't know why the Democrats won't talk about it. I guess they see broader enfranchisement as a threat to some of their voting patterns. I don't know.
Well, it's a good point, because I know that when I first encountered this, I felt that little sense of, wait a minute, maybe it would make a person want to run away from in being involved in the process in voting, which would of course hurt Democrats up and down the ticket, because Republicans benefit from low turnout.
Right.
So maybe that's why they're not pushing as much as they should. But I think that's backwards. I think that we should make sure that we educate people about the situation. And then Greg Palast's piece on the motherlode of voting of vote scams, he talks about the Koch brothers extensively and how they went from getting all their money off a Indian reservation how they built that into a $1 billion enterprise and bought Congress and Bob Dole and all these different folks, and then turned those billions into the Heritage Foundation, into these various different things that attack the
Cato.
EPA.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to see how easily you can tie these right wing Koch brothers to Trump, to Chris Kobach, to CrossCheck. And there's just no way that I'm going to be quiet about that.
Yeah.
Right? You know,
the Koch brothers didn't get behind Trump that much, and they didn't actually give a lot of money. They gave a lot of money to outside sources.
But it's certainly no coincidence that he's doing exactly what they want him to
right.
do.
Right. Well,
EPA.
He knows that, you know, somebody in there knows who they're beholden to.
Thanks, man. You have a good one.
All right. Enjoy the day. Okay, I got a long Tana Hazy Coates interview with Jeremy Scahill that I find riveting. Covers a lot of subjects, including Americans' national pastime. There'll people that argue that football isn't that, but given the amount of money involved, I gather. Free labor from these college athletes who beat themselves to a pulp, and then maybe get an NFL high-paying or medium-paying job. Anyway, and a British, a UK NFL player, huh? That must be a cultural shift. Well, 6 minutes in already, the interview Jeremy Scahill did on the latest Intercepted, they are actually fundraising. They want listener sponsors for their podcast. So I wanted to mention that at the top. I need to communicate with them again. It's a project of First Look Media, got their money from somebody from PayPal, I guess, but he and Glenn Greenwald and Naomi Klein, I think, are doing some great work. Everything's problematic, can be argued. I have had misgivings about Mr. Coates. Maybe I should just read more of his stuff. He's had a book a year for the last decade, apparently, and is currently reading the biography of Ulysses Grant and finding it engaging. One of his books is on the Civil War. So I think it's worth running the whole thing. Got some Mumia Abu-Jamal. I don't even know if Black Agenda has an item up this week. Maybe I'll tag it on the end if I have time. A lot of stuff going on around town. We've got some WEFT volunteers parking cars for the football fans. That's down on South Neal, if I call correctly. Maybe somebody can fine-tune that. Be looking forward to Carol Ammons inviting the scholar from Northwestern down to talk about Korea. It's the department that was Bruce Cummings was involved with. He's a scholar on Korea. Used to get interviewed on PBS, but I don't know. I mean, to look him up to see whether he's in hiatus or something. But he was active, and they were still not calling him some years ago. Did a brilliant intro to I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War, which I still recommend. It's contemporaneous writings by the outsider journalist I.F. Stone. He's mentioned in Amy Goodman's column today, which we'll be getting straight away. But we're going to kick it off with Mumi Abu-Jamal's commentary on colonial PR, Puerto Rico, and the ongoing tragedy there.
Puerto Rico, a colony by any name. On Christopher Columbus's second voyage to what was called the West Indies, he visited Puerto Rico, called Borinquen by the Arawak natives of the island. Columbus docked in November 1493. And with him came the force and greed of the Spanish Empire. For four centuries, Spain brought imperial exploitation, slavery, repression, and death to the Arawaks, and in its place arose a new people, the mixture of Southern Europe, Spain, the remnants of Indians and Africans. After the U.S. pushed a weakened Spain out of Cuba, it seized Puerto Rico as well. From that seizure of 1898 by the U.S. until today, Puerto Rico has been an American property under the U.S. government's thumb. Did you know that Puerto Ricans can't vote for president? That they on the island can't vote in general elections? They fight in every American war and die in every conflict. When U.S. businesses open up shop in PR, they are exempt from taxes, money that could aid the island in its health and educational needs. And just days ago, after being lashed by nature's fury as Hurricane Maria, when they dared complain about slow American response, the moronic U.S. president called Puerto Ricans ingrates. Ingrates. Now, weeks later, they are still suffering. No water, no food, no power. They are Americans in name, but in fact, they are colonial subjects of the U.S. Empire, used by America, and then forgotten. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Legendary independent journalist I.F. Stone, known as Izzy, often cautioned all governments lie. But even Izzy would have been dizzy with a deluge of lies pouring out of the Trump administration, including President Donald Trump's claim that human-induced climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese to hurt the U.S. economy. Global warming has exacerbated recent catastrophic events from Houston to Miami to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and now to raging fires sweeping across California. The corporate TV weather reporting aids and abets Trump's misinformation by consistently ignoring the role of climate change in this string of disasters. This year's hurricanes have struck with historic force. On our warming planet with rapidly warming oceans, hurricanes occur with more frequency and more strength. The 10th hurricane this year, Ophelia, has just been named. There have not been 10 hurricanes in one season since 1893. At least 82 people died when Hurricane Harvey slammed into the Gulf Coast, inundating Houston. The storm also led to millions of pounds of pollutants being released into the air and water by Houston's sprawling petrochemical industries. Initial estimates for the rebuilding are currently about $190 billion. Hurricane Irma killed at least 134 people, of whom 90 were in the United States, including 14 elderly residents who were trapped in a hot, flooded, blacked-out nursing home in Hollywood, Florida. AccuWeather's founder and president, Dr. Joel N. Myers, said, "Also unprecedented is that this particular storm, Irma, has sustained intensity for the longest period of time of any hurricane or typhoon in any ocean of the world since the satellite era began." His initial cost estimate for recovery from Irma, primarily in Florida, is $100 billion. Hurricane Maria's devastation of Puerto Rico and the Caribbean has yet to be fully assessed. Puerto Rico had its entire grid destroyed. After 3 weeks, at least 85% of the island remains without electricity. The Federal Emergency Management Agency reported 63% of the island's 3.4 million residents have access to clean water, although that claim has not been independently verified. The official death toll in Puerto Rico alone at the time of this writing is 48, with scores still missing. But these are surely underestimates, as remote regions of the island have had very little contact with the outside world, and a new wave of serious infections related to poor sanitation are now afflicting people on the island. Even less is known about the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. In the aftermath of the storm, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz waded chest deep in floodwater, bullhorn in hand, helping people trapped in their homes and organizing rescue operations. Her repeated urgent calls for more help to stem the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico were rebuffed by FEMA Chief Brock Long, who called her public cries political noise. Trump himself accused the mayor of being nasty, then engaged in a shockingly insensitive stunt during his short visit to the island, throwing rolls of paper towels into a crowd of hurricane survivors. Across the United States and California, over 20 wildfires are sweeping across the state. In Sonoma and Napa, fires have wiped out entire neighborhoods, turning thousands of homes into piles of smoldering ash and forcing the evacuation of tens of thousands. At the time of this writing, 21 people are confirmed dead from the fires, but hundreds are reported missing. Scientists have found a direct link between climate change and the fires in California. Park Williams, bioclimatologist at the Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, told us on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The amount of area that is burned due to human-caused climate change, and we find that about half of the area of forests in the western U.S. that have burned over the last 35 years is attributable to that warming trend. And that half is really big. It equals the size of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined.
When asked about the failure of network TV meteorologists to make the connection between extreme weather and climate change, climatologist Park Williams said,
"The term global warming and the term climate change have been politicized, but in the circles that I work with real climatologists who are working on these issues every day, there's no hesitation to use those terms. As you put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the globe warms, whether it's the Earth or another planet. It's just a law of physics. And so it is surprising to see trained meteorologists on TV steer away from those terms."
It's not only surprising. This massive omission reinforces the efforts of climate change deniers to confuse the American public and stall climate action. You have to ask, if we had state media in this country, how would it be any different? President Trump has withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement, his Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, declaring the war on coal is over, signed an order intending to rescind President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which would have curbed polluting power plant emissions. The Trump administration's lies about climate change are having real impacts today. More devastatingly, the lies all but guarantee a future filled with more and more deadly disasters. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, we have just enough time to play the Intercepted's Jeremy Scahill's interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, and I've got a lot of stuff I'd like to talk about. I just put up a new Robert Perry article. I don't know the context. Russiagate jumps the shark, another critique of the media's response. $7,000 of the ads of the Russian-linked, one Russian-linked account were for a documentary called You've Been Trumped, a film about Donald Trump's efforts to build a golf course in Scotland along an environmentally sensitive coastline. Not something that could be seen as redounding to his popularity, it seems to me, unless you're just an avid golfer, I suppose. There is a new commentary from Glenn Ford, and it is about the Russiagate imploding. I don't know if he quotes Perry. Anyway, we're going to try and hear all of Ta-Nehisi Coates. I had to blank out and take out an expletive in a couple of places. I need to read the article they're talking about, the white president. This is the episode of The Intercepted called The White Stuff with Ta-Nehisi Coates. A couple of other interviews. It's an hour and 20 minutes long. I haven't checked it all out, but here's one of their little pastiches, and I don't understand all of the cultural references, but maybe you do. Thought about cutting it off, but what the heck.
Guess who's getting some class?
The media's fake.
Rodney Dangerfield's going back to school.
You have a lot of haters out there screaming questions. In the meantime, I'm here. It's sort of amazing. So I want to focus on North Korea. I want to focus on Iran. I want to focus on other things. I don't want to focus on fixing somebody's back or their knee.
Wait a minute. When did you dream about going to college?
We got very high marks. We got A pluses.
Here's a book on sex education.
Incredible. I love this.
The world's oldest living freshman.
This is my wheelhouse, and I understand it so well. It's fake news. There's nothing else you can say about it. It's like handing people money. We're going to have more money to spend on buying product and on doing what I do. I thought that when I got to the Oval Office, I would have a beautiful health care bill.
She is the teacher.
She is a great human being, but she's not a capable person. A sick person, but probably smart.
Actually, I'd like to join you, but I have class tonight.
Doing my nice buildings all over, in and out, in and out.
He's not just the big man on campus.
They have these beautiful soft towels, very good towels. The cheering was deafening. I'm here, and I sometimes ask myself, how did I ever get here?
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 31 of Intercepted.
We're going to have to do something with Obamacare because it's failing. Henry Kissinger does not want to pay 116% increase in his premiums, but that's what's happening, and it's actually getting worse. It's getting worse by the minute.
Donald Trump welcomed one of the most heinous war criminals in U.S. history, Henry Kissinger, back to the White House on Tuesday. And Trump used this horrid villain as his poster boy for trying to overturn Obamacare and strip millions of people of health care. Now, we should say that Kissinger's supporters are equal opportunity war crimes apologists. Hillary Clinton desperately tried to get Kissinger to endorse her in 2016, and other Democrats have heaped praise on Kissinger over the years. Let's be clear here. Henry Kissinger is the man who played a crucial role in the killing of more than a million Vietnamese and the saturation bombing of Laos, the genocide in East Timor. This is a man who helped overthrow governments, supported murderous death squads, and holds the distinction of being one of the premier killers of the modern era. Trump wheels out the almost lifeless corpus of Kissinger for a White House photo op and complains that Kissinger doesn't want to pay more for his health care. How many of Kissinger's victims are around to weigh in on the quality or cost of their health care? And also, Henry Kissinger is hardly eating cat food and living check to check. No, for his atrocious war crimes, he has been awarded this noble statesman status, celebrated by Democrats and Republicans alike. But it is fitting that Trump used Kissinger as his latest model for healthcare reform, because it's all based on a big lie. Just like Kissinger's status is based on the big lie that wars make us great, or that Vietnam was something other than a massive string of war crimes. But maybe there is truth in there somewhere, that the preferences of Henry Kissinger mean more than the health of poor and working people in this country, or the lives of the people who die at the hands of U.S. wars. I want Henry Kissinger to keep his government-subsidized health care, but in a prison cell, because that's the only thing Henry Kissinger should be a poster boy for.
It's really disheartening when everything that you were raised on, everything that I was raised on, was to be the best person I can be to help people that need help. And the Vice President of the United States is trying to confuse the message that we're trying to put out there.
This weekend, Vice President Mike Pence spent $250,000 of U.S. taxpayer money to very publicly make clear that his boss, Donald Trump, will pull out all the stops, make unlimited resources available, tirelessly raise public awareness around the clock to confront the growing menace of Black athletes protesting police killings of Black and brown people. Pence clumsily staged his version of a protest on Sunday when he pretended to be going to an NFL football game in Indiana. The press corps traveling with him was told to wait outside because the Secret Service believed Pence might only be inside for a brief time. Sure enough, when the national anthem began and players knelt in protest, Mike Pence and his wife left the stadium. Hilariously, Pence posted a photo on social media celebrating his walkout. But it turns out that it was a picture from 2014 that Mike Pence had just reposted. These guys seriously cannot do anything without screwing it up. Anyway, Trump, of course, couldn't contain himself, and he rushed to take credit for Mike Pence's walkout, tweeting that he had ordered Pence to leave if such disrespect was shown to the flag. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is to make this point. Mike Pence's little stunt wasn't really about confronting disrespect for the flag or the national anthem. This was about Trump showing his base that he won't tolerate such actions from Black people, even if they're millionaires. Trump also privately intervened in the operations of NFL franchises as his buddy Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, made clear when he said that Trump had reminded him of the NFL Game Ops Manual. Now, that's a document that dates back to the Vietnam War era, and it says that players should stand for the national anthem and remain silent while doing so out of respect. Jones said that he would bench any players who disrespect the anthem or the flag.
The policy and my actions are going to be that if you do not honor and stand for the flag in a way that a lot of our fans feel that you should, if that's not the case, then you won't play.
Trump celebrated Jones's position by tweeting, quote, "A big salute to Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys, who will bench players who disrespect our flag, stand for anthem or sit for game." This isn't really about the NFL or the flag. This is about white supremacy. Trump's position on this speaks to a long tradition in the U.S. of powerful white people despising disobedient or uppity black people. Contrast Trump's passion and his time commitment to attacking black athletes protesting police killings with how he talks about the white supremacists in Charlottesville, where a neo-Nazi ran over and killed a woman, where white supremacists gang beat an unarmed black man.
Very fine people on both sides.
Contrast Trump's obsession with black athletes disrespecting the flag and anthem to how he talks about John McCain's time as a prisoner of war.
I supported him. He lost. He let us down. But, you know, he lost. So I never liked him as much after that, because I don't like losers.
Now, I personally do not believe that John McCain is a war hero. Vietnam was a massive war crime. But what's interesting here is that Trump, who scrupulously avoided going to Vietnam, by the way, is attacking a guy who was a prisoner of war and then screaming constantly about black athletes disrespecting veterans. Contrast Trump's dedication to eradicating black athletes' protest to his response to the ongoing horrors in Puerto Rico. His administration just let the Jones Act waiver expire, making it even more difficult for aid to reach Puerto Rico. I mean, listen to how Trump talks about his now infamous throwing of paper towels at hurricane survivors.
They had these beautiful soft towels, very good towels. And I came in and there was a crowd of a lot of people and they were screaming and they were loving everything. And I was having fun. They were having fun. They said, throw them to me, Mr. President.
Donald Trump responds to black and brown people in a radically different way than he does to white people. Puerto Ricans, in his mind, should have been grateful to him. And any Puerto Rican who complains is dirt. He can call John McCain a loser for getting shot down in Vietnam, but black athletes can't exercise their First Amendment rights. Black athletes are sons of bitches, but the white shooter in Las Vegas is probably smart, according to Trump. This is a pattern that only the willfully ignorant can deny. And this isn't just about Trump at home. Trump's foreign policy is also rooted in white supremacy. He's re-escalating the war in Afghanistan. He's opened a criminal spigot to Saudi Arabia to keep the bombs dropping on Yemen. He has eased the restrictions for the U.S. military on killing civilians. He's considering expanding CIA drone operations. And Trump is threatening to wipe North Korea, a country of 25 million people, off the map. Part of the horrors emanating from Trump involve style and some involve substance. President Obama was a belligerent war president. So was Bill Clinton. So is Donald Trump. Trump is not really taking the war positions he is because he's Donald Trump. He's doing what American presidents do, albeit with some tweaks and differences here and there. But Trump says things that are horrifying. He openly lies. He chooses to inflame situations. So how much of Trump is who he is and what he believes, and how much of it is how he does it and how he speaks? Journalist and author Ta-Nehisi Coates recently wrote an article about Trump that has sparked a lot of discussion and debate. The title alone is very provocative, The First White President. It's a fascinating read, and it addresses the ways in which the eight-year presidency of the first black president, Barack Obama, was seized on by Trump to make his way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In the piece, Coates writes, quote, "It is often said that Trump has no real ideology, which is not true. His ideology is white supremacy, in all its truculent and sanctimonious power. To Trump, whiteness is neither notional nor symbolic, but is the very core of his power. In this, Trump is not singular. But whereas his forebears carried whiteness like an ancestral talisman, Trump cracked the glowing amulet open, releasing its eldritch energies. The repercussions are striking. Trump is the first president to have served in no public capacity before ascending to his perch, but more telling, Trump is also the first president to have publicly affirmed that his daughter is, quote, a piece of ass.
By the way, your daughter.
She's beautiful.
Can I say this? A piece of ass.
Yeah.
Coates continues, that is the point of white supremacy, to ensure that that which all others achieve with maximal effort, white people, particularly white men, achieve with minimal qualification. Barack Obama delivered to black people the hoary message that if they work twice as hard as white people, anything is possible. But Trump's counter is persuasive. Work half as hard as black people, and even more is possible. Trump truly is something new, the first president whose entire political existence hinges on the fact of a black president. And so it will not suffice to say that Trump is a white man like all the others who rose to become president. He must be called by his rightful honorific, America's first white president. Ta-Nehisi Coates has a new book that has just been released. It's a collection of his writings, and it's called We Were 8 Years in Power, and he joins me now. Ta-Nehisi, welcome to Intercepted.
Thanks for having me.
I think a lot of the focus, and I think a lot of people on social media, when your piece first came out, you know, on the first white president, I think there was a lot of people commenting on it that didn't actually read it. That was the sense that I had in the kind of initial blast. I was just talking to Ai Weiwei here, and he was saying that to him, Donald Trump is only more of a kind of extroverted version of what we've seen from the United States presidency in general. And I'm wondering if you see it that way, or if you think that, I mean, clearly we have a guy who is saying things and emboldening people that it's sort of become like, you don't really do that publicly, you know, if you hold political office. You have the Roy Moores of the world.
But what, he's a profane version of what a real American attitude to the rest of the world actually is.
Right, and that was his perception. Yeah. This is a guy who hasn't been in the United States for decades. He's in right. China, he's under assault there, and that was his perception. I'm just wondering if what you think of that analysis.
I am ill-qualified, but that feels true. I would never have thought of it like that. It's funny, you know, even like when the book ends, like sort of with an international perspective, because I think like one of the things that when you're in a group that's oppressed, there's a tendency sometimes to take comfort in that oppression. The idea that it makes you noble or exempts you from certain things, as opposed to seeing how maybe you're tied to other folks is oppression. And so like in this version of First White President, there's a part where I talk about, you know, to the rest of the world as Americans, maybe, you know, black people are white too. Do you understand? Like in the concept of whiteness as power, as oppressive power, that we're all, you know, actually kind of part of this. And so hearing that, I'm not shocked. That's a fascinating concept. You just blew my mind.
I mean, you're writing on the Obama presidency was, you know, they say a prophet is not someone that sees the future, but understands the times in which we live. And I always felt reading your writing about Obama that it was so unusual because it felt like the kind of analysis that you would get years removed from, you know, the reality that we're in. Mm. But the sort of flip side of Obama on a policy level was that when it came down to the brass tacks, this was a guy engaged in initiating new wars, mm-hmm. sustaining old wars, mm-hmm. you know, filled with contradictions. I think a lot of people projected onto Obama who they wanted him to be, mm-hmm. when in reality, a lot of his policies were sort of center or center right in the context of American politics. How do you reconcile that, the kind of minutia of what he did to build U.S. empire and the wars and all of that stuff, mm-hmm. with his sort of, you know, symbolic importance, but also who he was as president? It's mm-hmm. so different than mm-hmm. from Trump. Does it matter? You know?
Yeah, it does matter. But I think you're asking a pointed question. And I think, frankly, I am always called to that kind of reconciliation when I study any other president. How do I reconcile the fact that Lincoln, you know, ultimately led the war that emancipated 4 million enslaved African Americans, and at the same time, you know, very much held white supremacist attitudes, advocated the colonization of black people out of this country? How do I reconcile Lyndon Johnson, pioneer in terms of civil rights legislation in the Vietnam War? How do I reconcile Franklin Delano Roosevelt for his efforts in strengthening the social safety net? You're doing that on the back of white supremacy in the South. It's tough, man. It's tough. You know, I was in this is very interesting. I was in Chicago doing some reporting, right? I was arguing with these guys, you know, in the academy. I love a bunch of historians. I love arguing with historians. And I said, Obama's a great president. And they go, oh, you know, they all get upset, right? And I said, well, you know, the question you have to, and I said, by the scales of what the American presidency is, not he's a great person, but in terms of what the American presidency is, he's great. And you know, we're going back and forth. And I said to one, I said, okay, so who's a great president? And one of the professors says, Lyndon Johnson without Vietnam. She was joking.
Oh, yeah. She was trolling
like,
you.
Yeah,
no,
she was trolling Lyndon Johnson without Vietnam. So then, but one of the other guys said something really profound. I said, listen, you have to say what, you know, within an American context, given the populace we have, given that we can't elect a new people, what would be great? And the guy said to me, he was a philosophy major. I should have known. he says, I'm not invested in those categories. I'm not like, I reject the whole argument. And I left that thinking about that the whole night, like maybe the presidency, and I haven't fully fleshed this out, but maybe like the presidency in terms of what it is, we shouldn't think of people that have that job as great ever. Like it's not possible to be great. Implicit in it are certain things that are not possible to salute, are not possible to reconcile. Obviously, you know, I advocate participation in the democratic process, but maybe that should always be done like with a kind of skepticism of any sort of, you know, rah, 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 et cetera. It was actually a profound point. I haven't, as you can tell, fully decided what that meant, but it was a check. It definitely stopped me from calling him great. Mm-hmm. You know, it was an important check.
I mean, it was interesting when Obama was running first time, when he was running for president,
you had to look for it because it wasn't part of the stump speech. But Obama has had this incredible grasp of a history in this country that generally is thought of like what Howard Zinn wrote about and not the kind of examples that a presidential candidate gives on the campaign trail. He talked about the workers on trains in this country, the porters and others and the strikes and the idea that some leaders were saying at the time in the 1940s, you have to make me do it. You have to hold me accountable. You always got this, or I always got this sense that, Obama.
Isn't that a myth too? Isn't that a myth? I think that quote is.
Is what I'm saying. The examples that Obama would give, and this is what I'm getting at.
Right.
The examples that Obama would give had this kind of foundation to them that was different than big mainstream political candidates typically would have had. But if you peel back the layers of them, they're almost like a neoliberal version of Howard Zinn rather than like any attachment to a truly radical different idea.
Yeah, no, I think in the book, like the phrase I use is conservative revolutionary, by which I mean the fact of a black president was revolutionary, but he's an establishmentarian. He's conservative, clearly. He believes in American institutions. He believes that, America is, and he would just say this unadulterated, a force for good in the world. He probably would have more nuance making that argument than George Bush would have if you sat down and had him talk about it. But he believes in, I'll just say this, in the country in a way that I probably don't. The question I always have, though, is what is possible for an American president? And maybe that takes me back to the logic that I should have rejected in the first place. But where are our expectations for what it should be? And I'm not saying in terms of what should we protest and what should we not, what should we object to and what should we not. But his foreign policy specifically, were you surprised? I wasn't really surprised.
No. And in fact, you and I are from the same generation. Part of it was that I came of age or became an adult when Bill Clinton was president.
Right.
And the first war that I covered was under Clinton. I was in Iraq in the 90s. I was in Yugoslavia in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe because I ended up becoming a reporter, I didn't really view Bush as this epic departure from Clinton. Right. Iraq was a mass killing on a mass scale. Right. But Clinton was, Noam Chomsky called it the new military humanism. Right. He wrapped everything in humanitarian, these cruise missiles that we were raining down, it was for humanitarian purposes. Right. But when you look at it, it's a pretty consistent, there's never been some huge circuit breaker.
Well, in the difference of an American president. Bush, especially after 9/11, had a vision of remaking the world. Now, obviously, Clinton would rain down bombs on people, but the idea of, for instance, remaking Yugoslavia, wasn't present. I think also those guys, not to get too off subject, but I think they were haunted by Rwanda. I think that looms large in a lot of people's minds and the price of not intervening and what that could look like.
No doubt about that. And you had the neoconservatives. People throw that around a lot.
Right.
But these were people that spent the 8 dark years of the Clinton era preparing a game plan for the day they took power.
Right.
I'm wondering what you think of the kind of recent embrace of George Bush, but also people like Bill Kristol and David Frum and others by kind of liberals or Democrats, et cetera, because of the Trump-Russia stuff.
It makes me uneasy. it makes me uneasy because... I guess on one level, they are taking a somewhat courageous route in the sense that they're not simply, because there are people who are clearly not doing this like a Tucker Carlson or a Dinesh D'Souza, who I actually believe know better, and are just, turning it into a complete racket. So, we can at least say that. But I don't think it should obscure the fact that we have profound differences with folks. I just don't think that should be missed or forgotten. I certainly don't forget it.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Yeah, I struggle with this on a personal level too. Like, is there any forgiveness that anyone should ever lend David Frum for writing the Axis of Evil speech?
Yeah.
Is there a level at which we should?
I probably could imagine some things he could do. You know what it would require? I was completely wrong about that. It led to a massive humanitarian catastrophe. And I just really, really shouldn't have done it. And it will affect all the work I do going forward. I will always remember that. I don't think people should necessarily be banished from public life, but they need to be straight up. You know what I mean? They need to be really, really straight up about their mistakes and not act like this was some, game of chess or something.
I think you're right on the money there. I hadn't thought about it in the way you just put it, but I think that's the biggest part of what I find offensive about the whole thing is that it's like all is forgiven. And it's like a million people died in that war.
That's
and it's
right.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not going to just retweet you talking about the latest Russia shit.
No, but we just don't see it. It is, I keep talking about this piece because it really bugged me out, but Evan Osnos did this piece on North Korea in the New Yorker, and I think one of the most effective things he was able to show, obviously, North Korea, totalitarian, authoritarian state, but they have a memory of the Korean War that Americans just have no idea about. Curtis LeMay raining down bombs, and that means something to them. Like that, and we just have no access to it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that, and maybe it, to some extent it was always this way, but in terms of what, you know, the notion that what is wrong with Iraq is the number of American soldiers who died. That's what's actually wrong with Iraq. That sort of perspective, it's scary. You know, it's scary.
Well, and you see with the Take a Knee protests, and it's now so far away from the original point that Colin Kaepernick and others were, right, were making. It's been co-opted by some, or it's right, been characterized as an attack on the troops by others. But it's like, there's a long history in this country of connecting the dots between what the American government says it is and what the American government does around the world. And right, we're nowadays, it's like we're called to some kind of bizarre, superficial patriotism, or else we're against the troops. And yeah, it's like, what's wrong with saying what the troops did is criminal? Them being sent there was criminal. I mean, it's...
Can't say that.
Right. And especially black men can't say that even, you know, more.
And here's the worst part. Like, there was nothing he could have done. So initially, people don't remember this, but he was actually sitting down on a bench. And that was thought to be disrespectful. He went and talked to a veteran who apparently had some politics and had, you know, some... And he said, listen, I get it. Okay, you want to, you know, you want to protest. One thing you might be able to do that might make this go over bad is if you took a knee. People have forgotten. People forgot that taking a knee actually was the compromise. It was the attempt to show some level of respect. You know, there's nothing he could have done differently that would have made this okay.
We should have a split screen, though, of Kaepernick or other people on their knee. Although, I mean, no, Kaepernick's not on a team right now.
Right.
And then, like, any random white guy sitting on their couch with their feet up during the national anthem. Because it's
right,
like, oh, that's your respect for
right,
the national
right,
anthem.
Right. No, it's true.
But it's I think it's in part, it's because they are black men doing
no,
it.
No, that's definitely it. And then there's the entire labor politics of the NFL, which I think play into this. People do not think of those guys as workers, despite the fact they basically play for free all through college, you know, bash their brains in, you know, subject themselves to all sorts of, you know, illness and injury. I mean, again, to the point of like your brain, like literally, you know, your brain being affected, go into a league in which, yeah, they're, you know, workers who are making millions, but effectively working for people who make billions, and then are told to be grateful in a way that the owners, you know, are not told to be grateful. They have all sorts of problems in terms of healthcare. And once they get out of the league, after basically preparing their entire lives to do one thing and transitioning out, it's very hard for black men or black people in that position to make a case for themselves as actual workers. No one sees them that way. It's just people who are lucky, who should be grateful. You know what I mean? It's obscene.
Yeah, and that is a lot of the pushback that's written by, you know, the thought pieces. That's basically the point. Why should we have sympathy for any of these, right, you know, multimillionaires?
Right. But they have sympathy for the owners.
Right, of course. And then, yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're a billionaire, you know, no one says, you know, Donald Trump should you know, was lucky. You know what I mean? No one perceives Donald Trump as lucky. You know what I mean? People perceive him as, you know, a really smart businessman.
I want to ask you about reparations, but something you said about North Korea, I think, is relevant to this. You know, you were talking about how North Koreans still live with that memory of the U.S. role in destroying Korea and also in that war. In the United States, when these shootings happen, like we saw in Las Vegas, immediately the Sean Hannitys of the world go to, oh, well, look at Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the murder rates in Chicago and the guns that are in Chicago. What's interesting, you know, about all of this is no one ever raises the psychological and economic impact that slavery continues to have to this day. Do you think that there is ever a time that we could have in our lifetime where the political discussion of reparations would ever be on the table?
The important thing is to say what that would look like. And then, you know, we can answer the question that way. Most of the time when people conceive of reparations, they conceive of like a judgment from the Supreme Court or like Congress, you know, passing a bill that gets signed by the president. But I think much more likely to happen, if this were to happen, would be a wave of smaller individual acts of reparations. For instance, you know, there was a reparations bill in the city council in Chicago for police brutality. There have been reparations acts, I think it was in North Carolina, where they were sterilizing women. I believe in Virginia also, where they shut down the schools during massive resistance to Brown versus the Board. I think what you would see is a growing consensus that, in fact, you know, government and private business on all levels of society, you know, colluded to put black people in certain situations, but as far as I'm concerned, to pilfer and plunder wealth from those communities. And it would be a series of much, much smaller things. I don't think it would be one federal act. Could you get to that in our lifetime? I don't think so. I think the work of this, and I encourage people to think about this like as a multi-generational struggle. I think the work of this lifetime is to get people to at least acknowledge the case. You know, for there to be no, I mean, one of the things like I took a lot of heat over for the case for reparations was not outlining an actual plan. But that's because people don't believe the case. I mean, the first thing is to get actually to people to admit, yes, you're owed. You know what I mean? And then maybe you can have a conversation, you know, about the, you know, how do we actually, you know, remedy that debt? But I think that's this generation's work. I mean, we could get by the end of my lifetime for people to say, yeah, you know, we really screwed y'all. I mean, that would be serious, serious progress.
Why don't we talk more in this country about why certain areas of this country are the way that they are, yeah, with housing, with economics?
So there's a way that people see the Civil War, and the historian James McPherson calls it the violent football game theory of the Civil War, where there actually are no real principles at stake, where, you know, Southern people acted honorably, Northern people acted honorably. They just had some sort of disagreement, and then, you know, there was reunion, and that was, you know, for the battle. We're sorry we had a Civil War, but... And slavery is not included in that. Part of the period after Reconstruction and real reunification of the United States was telling a story, telling that story, actually, telling the story of the violent football game. The South didn't have to feel bad about doing anything. The North didn't have to feel bad about doing anything. And expunging Black people from the historical record. It is only within that generation of historians that came up in the 1960s and a tradition of Black historians who were basically completely ignored. It's only within, you know, the lifetime, you know, of historians who are still living right now, that people begin to see Reconstruction, Redemption, so for what it actually was. And so I think, if I'm being optimistic and hopeful, that the case has not yet filtered down. It took a long time to build that myth. Immediately afterwards, you know, the generals who fought with Robert E. Lee begin building this lost cause mythology, you know, and it, you know, crescendos with, you know, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. And people believe it, such to the point that, you know, HBO is announcing this show, Confederate, and they still don't understand what's wrong. They just don't. They don't get it. They don't get, like, why that's wrong. And to some extent, I'm forgiving. You know, it's like when I heard Hillary Clinton during the campaign talk about how bad Reconstruction was and if Lincoln was alive. And the thing I had to remember, as wrong as that was that was probably the logic when she went to school. That was, you know, probably very, and I'm talking about like in the college, into her colleges, like not just in it, like that was probably what she was taught because that was what the theory was. We just haven't, we haven't come out of the haze yet, man.
You know, he was willing to reconcile and forgive. And I don't know what our country might have been like had he not been murdered. But I bet that it might have been a little less rancorous, a little more forgiving and tolerant, that might possibly have brought people back together more quickly.
We were just talking the other day to the historian Jean Theo Harris. She has a book coming out in January about the sanitizing of the legacies of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther mm-hmm. King. And she also wrote a biography of Rosa Parks, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Mm. That's phenomenal. You write about Malcolm X, and I'm wondering what your assessment is of how Malcolm X appears in our discourse today and the way that he's sort of referenced. He's not often referenced in American politics, right, but in American culture, Malcolm X is often remembered. And what's your analysis of how he is generally remembered these days?
Obviously, he's been softened and made accessible to broad groups of people. You know, the question I wonder, though, is, and I feel like I'm always asking this question. It goes back to the question about, you know, Barack Obama and the presidency. What is, like, the alternative? Does this ultimately happen to any, you know, sort of revolutionary figure? I mean, you really could make the same case about Martin Luther King. I mean, people have forgotten that from the highest, at the highest levels of government, King was harassed until the end of his days. They think, like, him and Johnson and Kennedy were all great friends. And, you know, they forget that they authorized the bugging and the harassment. And so he's been softened too. But if you're going to have a national holiday for King, is this what societies do? Like, do they turn, you know, these revolutionary figures, like, do they have to soften them in order for them to gain the kind of acceptance that, you know, the people who follow them, Black folks who, you know, seeing them actually want?
Well, in a bizarro world, that's sort of what happened with Obama at the beginning of his run. He, mm-hmm. A lot of people projected onto him what they wanted him to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that 2004 speech at the Democratic National Convention was a very sophisticated piece of propaganda. No, but it was a sophisticated piece
was,
of propaganda.
It really was.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a Black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
Even his October 2002, speaking against the war. But I do think both Black and white
people... against all wars.
Only stupid
wars.
Yeah. I don't oppose war in all circumstances. And when I look out over this crowd today, I know there is no shortage of patriots or patriotism. What I do oppose is a dumb war.
But people would project onto him, oh, he's the anti-war candidate. Yeah. But it's a similar phenomenon that's happening with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, but in a different realm.
Right.
Sanitizing them later. But with Obama, it was like making him what we want him to be.
You know, my great failing as a journalist is that I think I've gone pretty deep on American society, but I don't have comparisons across in other societies? Are there other places where people have a realistic apprehension of their heroes, you know, where this kind of sanitization does not happen? Or is myth and all of the problems of myth like a necessary element in order to make a society cohere in some sort of way, in order, you know, so that we aren't all like out in the streets killing each other?
What's your answer thus far to your own question?
I hope that it's not necessary. My intuition is that it is. But then, you know, I guess I'm conflicted on that, because I think, like, you know, this is a country that holds itself as the light of the world in terms of democracy, that believes that it's ahead. And so I don't know that the standard of, if that's your logic, if that's what you're saying, you're not just saying we're, you know, just one among, you know, no, you believe that you're touched by God. If that's what you believe, then I don't know that standard works. And certainly there's a history of ideas. So it doesn't mean that because all societies are this way, the society necessarily has to be this way. So I don't know, but I know in my work, it's in fact, even in the times interviewing Obama, like, you know, when I would go in and I would talk to him, I would always have to come home and face myself on that question. Okay, Ta-Nehisi, but you have to articulate some other way within the constraints of what the American populace is, within the constraints of what America itself is. You have to articulate some other vision. Now, there were, you know, policy points where I could say, or you know, things he did, specific things I could say, you could have done this, you could have done that. But in a broader sense, in terms of what you're talking about, because I think you're talking about something more, you know, global, you know, in terms of his policies. I don't know, man. I got to tell you, I always had trouble with that.
What's your impression in general of Bernie Sanders?
I think his race in 2016 was really, really important. I think actually having somebody in the race, in the primary, saying things that 10 years ago people thought were unsayable in the Democratic Party, someone, especially, you know, in the wake of everything that happened in terms of, you know, the economy and the collapse and everything, somebody out and out saying, you know, these guys are villainous and they got away with something. Somebody, you know, really saying that, somebody not just retreating, you know, too big to jail. And see, I believe in that, even if, you know, there's this critique, well, you shouldn't say it unless you have a plan. You know, that's like Hillary Clinton, unless you have a, but I actually, I don't believe that. I think ideas are actually important. So I was, you know, encouraged and, you know, incredibly heartened that he was in the race. I voted for him in the primary. In terms of my politics, I'm certainly much closer to him than I was, you know, to Hillary Clinton. I think he should have more black and brown people around him. Maybe he's fixed that. I don't know. But certainly in the things I heard after the election, it's, and I just want to be clear, I don't think he's alone in this, right? I think this is actually across, you know, the liberal left spectrum. But you can't say you're ashamed of the Democratic Party's ability to speak to the white working class and talk about how you're from the white working class and then get on some kid, you know, who's talking about being a Latina. You got to pick one. You got to pick one. You can't say it's identity politics when these people do it and not when you do it. I don't even think we should, you know, adopt that language, you know, which is really, as far as I'm concerned, conservative, you know, right wing language. I know there's a critique on that, you know, in terms of leftists, but I don't think we should even be in the business of adopting that language. I don't know what's in conflict about being in favor of single payer healthcare, being in favor of a much, much more robust social safety net, being aggressively anti-war, and frankly saying you're for reparations. Now, I understand why he might not say that. Like, I got that. In terms of what I wrote, which bugged me, was the complete hand-wavy, you know, aspect of it from somebody who was so imaginative. You know, if we're going to be imaginative about those things, you know, be imaginative about these things too. In the 1970s, the incarceration rate in this country was roughly about the same as it was in all other, you know, westernized democracies. I guess somewhere between 100 and 200. Last I checked, we were at about 700 per 100,000. How are we going to get back to normal? You're going to have to say some things that are not sayable right now. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to have to think in some sort of imaginative way. And when you say those things, it will not be missed that a lot of those people are black. That just won't be missed. It's not even missed when you make what looks like, you know, sort of raceless or colorless or identityless points without identity, that in fact, a lot of black people, you know, will be helped. There's a reason why the ACA in Glenn Beck's mouth became reparations. People see it. People see it. And so I don't think it's a fight that can be gotten away from. I know some folks feel like I'm either or, I'm not either or, to the extent that, you know, I stress race. It's because I think it's the missing thing, you know, in that platform that has got to be picked up and directly engaged.
Do you think, though, that the Democratic Party has outgrown its value at all? I mean, like, if Bernie had, of course, he would have gone down as the man that gave us Trump either way, but he already is blamed that way by a lot of Hillary's people. Right. But if Bernie had said, actually,
I don't say him that way.
I'm not going to. No, I know you don't. I'm saying that's how Team Hillary presents it.
She says it in a book.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah. But if Bernie Sanders had said, you know what, this is too corporate of an agenda for me. It's too soft on all these things. I'm going to run an independent campaign. And actually, it would have shattered the Democratic Party.
It would have. It would have.
But would it have been a bad thing?
Yeah.
You think so?
I do. I mean,
well, Trump won anyway. So
yeah, Trump won anyway. As I understand it, what happened was he realized too late that he could actually win. I think that's what happened. I think initially, you know, there was some sense. Listen, I don't want to, you know, to the contrary, which he says, I think his sense was, I don't want to injure anybody. You know, I don't want, you know, a Republican to win. And then it became clear he actually had quite a bit of appeal and that a lot of people were actually holding their nose voting for Hillary. I think that our system of government in general is limited. There was a great column about a week ago in the Times from Michelle Goldberg on the possibility of minority rule. And man, that scares the hell out of me. I mean, just the very, you know, take the electoral college, take the ability, take the fact that we don't have a national voting system, you know, which you have in other countries, that states can, you know, make their own laws and jigger, you know, mess around with the districts. What scares me is, you know, we are, and I guess we're already here. I mean, what am I saying? You know, what scares me is if we're going to get there, where, you know, on a presidential level, you know, and I guess to some degree, you know, on a Senate level right now, you don't really have the will of the people actually being represented. That is a bad, bad scenario. That's a really, really, really bad place to be. I know I'm veering. What I'm trying to say is I think the whole setup is really problematic and will increasingly become so, especially as the demographics of the country change. You combine that with the systemic problems that were already there. I don't know. I see trouble.
All right, last two questions. First, what are you reading these days? I mean, I know you're on tour. What are you reading? What music are you listening to?
I am reading Ron Chernow's great Ulysses Grant biography. It's excellent, exceptional. I highly, highly recommend it. It's long, but doesn't even feel like it's long. And I think it's one of the See, it's interesting. Like I was just saying, like you were talking about reconciling, right? And Grant is an interesting guy because he was born into an abolitionist family. He marries, you know, into a slaveholding family. He goes off, you know, and serves in the Mexican War, comes home, is dirt broke, can't do anything, can't make a living. And through his wife's family, he inherits an enslaved African-American. And within a relatively brief period, I don't know when, he goes to the courthouse and he says, you know, he emancipates the slave. And I was thinking the other day, this is like maybe the most heroic thing like I've seen somebody do in their private life who, you know, went on to become president because he was dirt broke and that was a lot of money. He just sort of like he didn't say, I want to be rid of this, so I'm going to sell it. You know, I'm going to sell this person. He parted with that. And I just, despite what I said about greatness, I love that dude. I love how he was completely underestimated. I love how people thought he was stupid when in fact he was, you know, a great, you know, reader, you know, and ended up being a great writer, wrote, a, you know, arguably the best, you know, presidential memoirs. So I'm really loving that book. In terms of what I'm listening to, I'm listening to a ton of Marvin Gaye right now. I know that's old, but I'm listening to a lot of Marvin Gaye.
All right. Well, thank you very much, man, for joining us on Intercepted. Right.
Thanks for having me.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author of the new book, We Were 8 Years in Power. We're going to post the full interview I did with Ta-Nehisi Coates later in the week. We also talked about his Black Panther comic books, the Democratic Party, and much more. That will be on TheIntercept.com.
And that's Jeremy Scahill, and that was already 45 minutes of Ta-Nehisi Coates. I don't know how much longer they went, maybe another 45 minutes. Pretty wide-ranging, for sure. I like John Pilger's quote about Trump. He's not an aberration. He's a caricature. And opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. It's time for Monitor. It's their KPFT seems to be in pledge drive, so they put up a previously aired show. I only found about that this morning. It includes Gareth Porter, the great Gareth Porter. So I didn't even think about trying to find a substitute for it. Let's see. There's a football game going on. Are people already parked? I don't know. So we got some WEF volunteers down on South Neal, I guess, parking cars, doing a little valet thing for a cost. I don't know if that's relevant anymore. I no idea. I know there's a Premier League game in a half hour on NBC broadcast TV. How about that? Not a very exciting one, though. I guess I'll just turn it over to Mark Badawi and monitor radio. Oh, I guess I should play something in the way of a community support announcement. And we'll do that right now. Gina will be in to do continuity through the next couple of hours when she's done parking everything. Thanks for listening. Help support WEFT and community media in general. We have an onslaught of media. Oh, I meant to mention something about Ta-Nehisi Coates. He was interviewed on Charlie Rose last night, and it was so insipid, I just, you know, forget about it. I listened to this one instead.